enjoy any time I get to be with you all back here at City Light Manayunk. I was in part of this congregation, obviously, and lived walking distance from here. Though I will say I'm disappointed. No more Ugly Moose and Deeks across the street. So that's I got to make different lunch plans. Is Bob's Diner still around? Is it still open? Okay, cool. So maybe I'll go there for lunch. I've also never preached three services before, so we're kind of unhinged here at this point. So we'll see what comes out. In any case, I am glad to be here because I love the people of this congregation, and every time I'm here, I see a lot of people I don't recognize, which encourages me because it means God's been working here apart from my efforts for the last 3.5 years, continuing to use this church for his glory and for the good of the people who are a part of it. I'm also here because, apart from just liking it, the passage that was just read for us could be a difficult one for a pastor of City Light Manayunk to preach. Could at least be awkward for them, because the first command of the passage is to respect those who labor among you and are over you in the Lord and admonish you, and to esteem them very highly in love because of their work. So for a City Light Manayunk pastor to preach that to you, he would have to get up here and say, respect me, esteem me very highly in love because of my work, okay? Go for it. They could do that, it's in the Bible, but we felt like maybe not. And it's actually not what's happening here in 1 Thessalonians. Because Paul, the guy who wrote 1 Thessalonians, does have a position of spiritual authority within the Thessalonian church. He's an apostle, an early church leader, but he's not actually laboring among them. So when he's telling them to respect their leaders, he's not talking about himself. And I feel like I'm in an analogous position with all of you. I'm an elder at this church, so yes, I have spiritual authority, but I'm not one of those who's laboring among you primarily here at City Light Manayunk. So when I talk today about respecting your leaders, I'm not talking about myself. I'm talking about your leaders here at City Light Manayunk. But even that command to respect your leaders is part of a bigger emphasis in this passage, a bigger thing that this passage is after, and it's this: to fight for the peace of your family. Fight for the peace of your family, a peaceful family. It sounds nice, right? It's a community in which you're known, in which you belong, where people not only are not fighting each other, but are actually for one another's good, a community that is whole and that is loving each other deeply. But to have that kind of community, you have to fight for it. And you have to be willing to even lay down the desire that's natural to all of us to fight for yourself when it conflicts with the peace of that family. So how do you do that? Well, this passage is going to give us three ways. First, respect your leaders, kind of what we've alluded to already. Second, don't let the funk get funkier. And third, reverse the funk. Okay, so first, respect your leaders. Worth noting at the outset that in this passage, Paul refers to the Thessalonians as his brothers in both verse 12 and in verse 14. And that includes sisters in Greek. But my point is, he's addressing a church as his family. So when I talk about fighting for the peace of your family, I'm not talking primarily about your spouse or your biological children or your biological brothers and sisters or whatever else may come to mind. I'm talking about your church, because your church is your family. And the first way you fight for the peace of your family is you respect those who labor among you and are over you in the Lord and admonish you and esteem them very highly in love because of their work. Now that word respect there is a word related to the word for knowing in the original language. And what it's saying is to begin respecting your leaders, the first thing you have to do is you have to recognize them as your leaders. You have to have people who you look at and say, you are over me in the Lord. Now, who would those people be? Well, this passage describes them first as those who labor among you. So remember now, Paul's not one of those. And there's evidence throughout this book, 1 Thessalonians, that was a sad thought for the Thessalonians. They liked Paul. Paul had planted the church there. Paul had labored fruitfully among them for a time, but now he was gone. And they were wishing that Paul was coming to see them and that he was laboring among them. But the way Paul handles that is he says, rather than wishing I was the one laboring among you, I want you to respect those who are laboring among you, who the Lord has given you. And so also for you today, rather than comparing your pastors at City Light Manayunk to your favorite celebrity pastor or to a former pastor that you had that perhaps you really appreciated, to a counselor, a therapist, anyone else, respect those who actually are laboring among you today. Let them be the ones that you look at and say, you are over me in the Lord. Now, I better clarify what it means for someone to be over you in the Lord. What it doesn't mean is that they're more loved by God, that they're more righteous in his sight in some way. In God's sight, they're just more brothers that are among you, right? Laboring among you. And yet, they are genuinely over you in the Lord. They have authority from God to make decisions and to set direction for the church that is not shared among all the members of the church. So today, there was a group of leaders that decided that we were going to preach on 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verses 12 to 15, and that I was going to be the guy that did it. And we didn't take a church vote on that, right? Like, there is direction being given to this church from those who lead it. Now, that doesn't mean they have absolute authority over you. That this is authority in the Lord, right? They're over you in the Lord. So that if your leaders ever direct you to do something that is contrary to what the Lord says in the Bible, you obey the Lord and not leaders. But they do have a genuine authority, not an absolute authority, but a genuine one, to under the authority of the Lord and in the Lord, lead the church in ways that are consistent with what the Lord has revealed in his word. And while the word for these leaders isn't used here, they come to be referred to as elders or pastors in the Bible, as the Bible develops and as the church develops. And that's still the term that we use for pastors and leaders here at City Light Church. Although, of course, the things in this passage would apply on kind of a secondary level to a city group leader or a volunteer team leader, and maybe even within your biological family. So, finally, they are described as those who admonish you. A Greek dictionary definition of that word is to counsel about avoidance or cessation of an improper course of conduct. So they tell you when certain things you're doing are wrong, and they tell you not to do them. And they tell you when certain things you may want to do would be wrong, and they tell you not to start doing them. When you're wrong, they tell you you're wrong. And then look at the way that we are directed to respond to such leaders. Verse 13. Esteem them very highly in love because of their work. Now, how many of you are like, yeah, that's exactly what I want to do when people tell me I'm wrong? Thank you. I just esteem you so highly in love because of this work. That's not my net. You know, my inner lawyer wants to come out, right? It doesn't come naturally to us. We all have a tendency, by our sinful nature, to resist any authority over us and to want to do what we want to do. Now, that's going to be a struggle for any sinner, which means me and you, anyone in the room. But there are certain cultural factors that the majority culture in America has that make that more difficult for those who have been influenced by it, that kind of exacerbate and give life to that sinful impulse. That's not even as true in minority cultures in America. So like at City Light Center City, we have black members of the church who I don't think know my first name because they just call me pastor. I have black ladies in my community who aren't even part of my church who call me pastor, because for them it would just be disrespectful for them not to address me that way. I have a friend in our denomination who's a pastor of a predominantly Latino church in central Pennsylvania. He planned a prayer meeting for 11 p.m. to 2 a.m. So not only is that a three-hour prayer meeting, it started at 11 p.m. His church came. Why? He's the pastor. Get your butt to the prayer meeting. We have Asian members of our congregation who tell me that in the churches they grew up in, you didn't question the pastor. The pastor was in authority, you weren't. Now, certainly, those ways of doing things can have their shortcomings too, right? There can be abuses. But why is it that a mentality that is so common in other cultures to respect your leaders, especially within the church, is so foreign to majority, predominantly white, Western American culture? Well, in the West, we've been heavily influenced by the idea that the autonomous individual self is basically good, and therefore that he or she ought to do whatever they want to do, and not have any authority over them, admonishing them, right? So the motto in the West is, I get to do what I want to do. Nobody tells me what I can and can't do. Now take that mentality and bring it into the church. And if someone with that mentality becomes a Christian and that's not addressed and repented of, what do you get? You get a mentality that says, okay, fine, I'll submit to God's authority, but no human tells me what's right or wrong in God's sight. I decide for myself. I know God. I know what he wants me to do. You don't get to admonish me. I've got a Bible. I might even read it. But I'm going to decide privately what's true and what's right or wrong for me. There's a guy named Tom Nichols, who's a professor that wrote a book in 2017 that made Amazon's best nonfiction books list. It's called The Death of Expertise, in which he details how in America today, it's seen as a virtue, actually, to reject the advice of experts and those who have authority over you. So like people will go to the doctor today with the mentality of, hey, look, I know you went to school for like 12 years and passed rigorous board examinations to hold the position you currently hold, but I read a few articles on WebMD, and I know what I have, okay? And if you don't write me that prescription, you're part of that corrupt medical establishment, right? So take that mentality and bring it into the church, and what do you find? There are no people over me in the Lord. I've got my Bible, I've got the Spirit, I know what I need. And so what's the role of a church leader in a person's life with that mentality? Well, it may be totally non-existent, as in the case of those who profess faith in Christ but are not meaningfully connected to a local church. On the other hand, you may get involved in a church, but you tend to treat the pastors as employees. You work for me to give me what I want from this church. And if you don't do it, I'm taking my money elsewhere. Instead of, you work for the Lord to give me what he wants from his church, and I esteem you highly in love for doing that work. So there are certain cultural factors that make this command perhaps harder for some than for others. But for all of us, regardless of your culture, we all have this nature that says, I want to do what I want to do. And anyone being over me in the Lord is a threat to that, right? They might tell me I'm wrong. They might lead the church in a different direction. I don't want that. Now, I know some of you are thinking, but you haven't seen the way those who were over me in the Lord have treated me. And you've got a point, actually. Because we've all heard the stories, right? We've all heard the stories of church leaders who have abused their positions of authority, who have been over others in the Lord, and have used that for selfish gain. And some of you have lived those stories, and you've got the scars to prove it. If that's you, if you've been significantly sinned against by church leaders, that's not your fault. And the pain that you feel as a result of that is not something that you need to just get over. It matters. But what you do with it is also your choice. Where you go from there is your choice. Get healing, get work on it. But it's not beyond the possibility that we as sinners could use such things as an excuse to never subject ourselves to those who are over us in the Lord, and to do what we want to do. It's not beyond the realm of possibility that people who have been hurt by the church, we've all been hurt by, if you've been a part of a church for more than a week, you've probably been hurt by the church, right? Like, I know there's differences when there's significant repeated sin, but it's possible that you've been sinned against in what really are kind of garden variety ways, and you've blown that up and used it as an excuse to not connect and not have anyone over you in the Lord. I'm not saying that is what you're doing, but it's possible, right? And you need to be aware of it. What we do all have in common is we have a choice. We have a choice as to whether we will esteem highly in love those who are over us in the Lord, or whether we will say, nobody's over me in the Lord. And if you go that route of nobody's over me in the Lord, or I'll kind of like grit my teeth and accept it, but I'm never going to esteem him highly in love, you will never have a peaceful family that way. Communities are not built that way. Like, why is, every other organization gets this, okay? Why is it that no professional sports team has said, you know, we're going to bag the whole coach thing? It's just, we don't need one. Everybody just decide what they think is best. Why is it there's no successful companies that have said, forget the whole boss thing. Board of directors, we don't need that. Why are there no classrooms? You know, forget the teachers. There's a new schooling method, no teachers. Just nobody does that because you realize that for communities to be healthy, communities have to be led. And for communities to be led, there has to be leaders. If you say, we're going to get rid of that, we're not going to submit to any of them, we're not going to honor them, you're not going to have a family. You're going to have a room full of individuals. A room full of individuals that are each kind of fighting for their own little private interests and their own little private rights against each other, rather than fighting for the peace of the family. But when you have a family, a church, that is led by pastors who are not using their position for selfish gain, but are leading the church in a God-glorifying direction, taking responsibility to do that, laying down their lives to work in that way among you, to oversee ministries, to counsel, to be there for you, to pray for you, to feed you God's word, and yes, to correct you when you go astray from it. If you have that kind of leadership and you honor those leaders, that's a family that can be whole. That's a family that can have peace. So the first thing to do to fight for the peace of your family is to respect those who labor among you, to esteem them very highly in love because of their work. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you 6 ways that you can practically do that. Because look, I'm a pastor, right? And I know this will probably be shocking, but there are some people that are harder to be a pastor to than others. And the difference is not necessarily, you know, oh, the people that are most spiritually mature and most involved, that helps, sure. But the difference really is when you're a pastor and you're interacting with someone who you know respects you and just wants your input in their life, you don't have to be defensive with them. You're kind of free to just be an instrument in the Lord's hands for whatever he wants to do in their lives. Now, some of that I need to grow in, frankly, right? I need to learn to pastor people who don't respect me. But I'm just telling you, like, you've got pastors, you've got great pastors here at City Light Manayunk, and you can make their job a lot harder, or you can make their job a lot easier. And if you make their job a lot easier, you're actually going to be empowering them to be better pastors to you, which I think is what you want, right? So here's six ways you can do that. First, become a covenant member of a gospel-preaching local church. If that's City Light, the next membership class here is June 23rd. Sign up for that. You can't do any of the things this passage is talking about if you're not a member of a church because you don't know who your leaders are. You don't have anyone you can point to and say, that's who's over me in the Lord. Membership is the way you identify who those leaders are. So that's a start. Second, devote specific and regular time to praying for your pastors. Don't just get to it when you get to it. Plan it, do it, pray for them by name. One of Satan's most common strategies to destroy the family of God is to attack the leaders. Your leaders are under spiritual attack. They need your prayers. Charles Spurgeon was a preacher in England in generations past, and very fruitful man. Thousands of people were converted to Christ under this guy's ministry. Like, you know how we do baptisms every so often, and we have people who were genuinely converted through this church? Imagine that happening on the scale of thousands. That's Charles Spurgeon's ministry. So one time someone asked him, how do you do it? You know, like, what's your secret? Why? How are you so fruitful in the ministry? Without hesitation, you know what he said? My people pray for me. Would you make it so the pastors of City Light Manayunk can say that without hesitation? My people pray for me. I heard from a city group at City Light Center City that on their prayer nights, they take time to specifically pray for me and for my family. I don't think I've ever felt more honored as a pastor than when I heard that. So pray for your pastors. Third, speak well of them, both to their face and behind their backs, and try to get specific. Matt, when you said that in your, you know, specific thing in your sermon, the Lord really used that to minister to me. Thank you for being used by him in that way. Tim, I know you oversee the staff at City Light Church, and every time I interact with the staff person, I just feel blessed by them. So I thank God for the culture that you're creating here through your role in this church. And then, this is the fun part, talk about them behind their backs in positive ways. Guys, aren't we blessed to have Paul overseeing these Sunday services? I'm so ministered to it. Aren't we blessed to have Mark overseeing our city groups? I'm so blessed by this city group. And isn't it great that Tom and Gordon and Nick do this work among us, and they don't even get paid by the church? Like, they're just doing this on top of everything else. That's awesome, right? Would you make City Light Manayunk a family that is marked by positive gossip? Positive gossip. Fourth, complain up. So in any family, there will be times when you disagree with the leadership. And the best way you can serve your family is not to just pretend that's not happening, right? I mean, small things, sure, just keep that to yourself. But we need your input, right? You're a part of this family, and your input matters if you're a member of this church. And so you should absolutely talk to someone about it, but you should talk up the chain to someone who is over you in the Lord, someone who's been entrusted with the spiritual maturity and authority to handle that kind of situation, not complaining horizontally and making your own little coup within the church to object to what the pastors are doing. And when you do approach them with suggestions, complaints, whatever, try to use first-person pronouns. I notice that we tend to struggle with such and such. What could I do to be a part of helping us grow in that? Instead of second person, you know, you guys aren't very good at this, and you need to fix this so you guys can get better at this. Or third-person pronouns, even worse. You're not even talking to them. You're complaining horizontally, and you're saying, aren't they terrible, and shouldn't they be doing better, and wouldn't it be better if we had different pastors at this church? And so fourth, complain up. Fifth, follow their direction. When City Light Manayunk leaders get up front and they announce the next strategic initiative or the next thing the church is doing, if it's not like a direct contradiction to the Bible, you should just assume that the Lord is leading them, and that's something that you ought to get behind. Get excited about the things that the leaders are excited about. Get excited about City Light Delco, right? Get excited about what God's doing through Andy, and we believe as a church that this is where the Lord's leading us. So go if the Lord's calling you there. If you're not called to move there, support it, give to it, pray for it. Get excited about the things the leaders are excited about. And then sixth, pay them. I saved this one because it's honestly not the reason any of your pastors are doing this job, and there's a lot of there's pastors in this church that don't get paid by the church. But for those who do, their family and their livelihood depends on that paycheck. And so I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't mention this. Throughout the Bible, this is like the most common way to honor the pastors who labor among you. You pay them for the work that they do. It's valuable work. So for most of you, that just means keep giving regularly, joyously, and sacrificially to this church. Start giving regularly, joyously, and sacrificially. Increase your giving. If you want to also get on the compensation committee and advocate for increases in pastor salaries, go right ahead, right? But for most of you, just regular, joyous, sacrificial giving, okay? So those are six ways that you can begin to respect your leaders and esteem them highly and love because of their work. Let's talk about the second way to fight for the peace of your family. Don't let the funk get funkier. Now, I have to honor one of my leaders here because I got this phrase from Pastor Matt Cohen, who normally preaches at this congregation. And what he means by it is, when you notice problems, that's the time to start addressing them. So like if the trash in your house starts to smell, that's the time to take it out. It's not going to start smelling better if you pretend it's not there. Don't let the funk get funkier. In verse 14, we see three groups of people who are experiencing various kinds of funk, right? The idle, the faint-hearted, and the weak. So in each case, the way to treat them, according to this passage, is not to ignore them, not to pretend the funk isn't there. It's to address it in some specific way to each one. And notice whose responsibility it is to address those things. Who is it in this passage that is to admonish the idle, encourage the faint-hearted, and help the weak? It's the brothers. It's the same people that respect their leaders. In other words, it's not the leaders. The leaders are supposed to do it too, but if you're in this room and you're a Christian, it is your job to encourage the faint-hearted, to admonish the idle, and to help the weak. If you're a Christian in this room, you are one another's responsibility, not simply the leader's responsibility. So what do you do? Well, providentially, we've already defined admonishing as when people are wrong, you tell them they're wrong, and you help them get on the path in the right direction. The idle would be those who are not fulfilling their responsibilities. They're busy with the wrong things. So it's like someone who's unwilling to work, someone who can't seem to get to work, lazy, someone who's not following through on their church commitments, but they always seem to have time to watch the latest TV show, hang out with the friends they want to hang out with, fulfill their hobbies. That's someone who's not heading in the right direction in life. And so the loving thing, the way to fight for the peace and not let the funk get funkier there, is to help them see, hey, this is the pattern I'm noticing. Here's where that leads. And I just want you to know there's a better way. I'll call you to that. So admonish the idle. Next, there's the faint-hearted. These are those who are actually moving in the right direction in life, right? They're running the race towards Jesus, but it's hard. Life's difficult. In Thessalonica, it's probably those who have experienced persecution or who have even lost family members and friends to persecution, who've been killed. And they're feeling like, man, is it worth it to follow Jesus in the midst of all this hardship? And what they need is not admonishing. Hey, cheer up. What's wrong with you? They need encouragement. And the kind of encouragement that Paul gives in this very letter, right? Patient sympathy, and in the Lord's timing, reminders of why it's worth it to follow Jesus even when it's hard, of the hope we have in the second coming of Christ and the resurrection of the body, even for those who have died already and for you as well. On the flip side, that kind of patient, sympathetic encouragement is actually not what you're supposed to give to the idle. A lot of people in the room today are conflict averse, right? And so we tend to want to just encourage everyone. That's a little easier, feels friendlier. But the idle shouldn't be encouraged. They're heading down the wrong path. They need admonishment to get on a different path. And then finally, there's the weak, who we are to help. So the weak, like the faint-hearted, are also heading in the right direction, but it's hard in ways that you can actually help. So like if somebody loses a loved one, you can't help that really. You can't bring them back. You can encourage that person though. But if somebody's materially poor, for example, and you're not, you can help that, right? You can give to that person. If somebody's weak in their understanding of the gospel, you can help that. If you're not, you can teach that person. See, a lot of times Christians will assume that people are idle, you know, that they're just hardened sinners, when they actually are just weak. They don't know any better. And so they don't need rebuke. They need to be instructed. hey, did you know that this is sin? Can I show you where in the Bible that it talks about this? Let's talk about that. Like, there's a better way here. And a lot of times, you know, you'll find people like, oh, wow, yeah, I didn't know that, and move in a different direction. And if they're idle, you can admonish them. Sometimes people who are materially poor, for example, they may want to work, actually, but they don't have a resume, they've never done that before, they don't have the right clothing for an interview. You can help such people rather than simply admonishing them and telling them how they're failing. And with all of them, be patient. Be patient with them all is where verse 14 leaves us. Engaging the funk is messy, okay? So we tend to want to avoid it, or we jump in and look for quick fixes. We're all messy, right? There has to be patience in order for there to be peace in the family. Whether they're idle, faint-hearted, or weak, be patient with them all. And finally, when the funk comes out and the evil is committed, as verse 15 says, see to it that no one repays anyone evil for evil. Not just don't you repay anyone evil for evil, but make sure in your community nobody is repaying anyone evil for evil. It's saying be that involved in the life of your community. Be engaged and fighting in the midst of your church to make sure that in your midst, when sins are committed against one another, those are confronted, repented of, and forgiveness is extended so that the funk doesn't keep getting funkier. And then finally, reverse the funk. How do you reverse the trend? Well, the final contrast in verse 15 is rather than repaying evil for evil, it doesn't just say, and sit on your hands and don't do anything. It says, don't repay anyone evil for evil, but always seek to do good. It's saying, take positive action to do good to one another and to everyone. To the very people who have done evil against you, seek to do good to those very people. Because think about this. If you're all just repaying evil for evil, where does that end, right? Someone hits you, you hit them back, they hit you back, you hit them back. The only time it ends is when someone gets hit, and instead of hitting back, they hug, right? They do good to another person. The problem we have is that in most conflicts, we want the other person to do that first. We say, well, once they get it right, once they fix it. But you see, you're still just fighting for yourself, right? It's all about you. If you're fighting for the peace of your family, you'll say, hey, I know they hit me. I know they haven't fixed it yet. But if I have an opportunity to bring peace out of this, I want to do that. I want to do good as far as it depends on me. And in fact, you won't even stop with your family because verse 15 ends with everyone, right? Always seek to do good to one another and to everyone. In all this talk of family, we just can't forget that we have neighbors who aren't part of the Christian family. And for the people in Thessalonica, those very neighbors were the ones persecuting them a lot of times. And so they had to hear, don't repay that evil for evil. When they persecute you, don't go fight back at them. And in fact, the early Christian community became known for that. It was one of the things that made them different from the other religious groups in the early centuries of the Roman Empire. When you went and burned down a Christian's house, they wouldn't come burn down your house. In fact, they even started to gain a reputation for doing proactive good outside of their own community. So we have an emperor, an old Roman emperor, who writes that the problem with the Christians is they don't just take care of their own poor, they take care of ours too. Now, that made them easier to persecute because they wouldn't fight back. But historians also point to the Christian practice of non-retaliation as one of the reasons under God that 300 years later, 50% of the Roman Empire called on the name of Christ from a fringe movement that was persecuted. They didn't beat their enemies by repaying them with evil. They won their enemies by repaying them with love. Now, I'm not saying that if you just repay evil with love, your enemies are going to lay down their swords and be your friends. Sometimes it doesn't happen that way. People keep fighting. I'm also not saying that if you're in a situation of abuse, that you make it easy for someone to keep abusing you and just try to repay good for the evil they're doing to you. But I am saying that insofar as it depends on you and it's genuinely for the good of the other person and furthering the goal of peace, that you not repay evil for evil and instead actually seek to do proactive good to the people who have wronged you. And God does often use that to turn enemies into family. And in fact, if you're a Christian, you know he does because it's happened to you. When you raised your fist against the Lord, he is the most powerful being in all, omnipotent, full of power, full of might. And he sends his son to earth, right? And what does his son come to do? To punch back? No. He comes to take the punch. He goes to the cross. And when he's on the cross and the nails are being driven in, he can rip right down off of that thing and conquer his enemies in a moment. And what does he do instead? He prays for them. Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. He does good to the very people who have wronged him. He did good to you when you were his enemy. He came to fight, not for himself. He came to fight for peace with you when you were his enemy, when you were fighting against him. You see, Jesus is not just over you in the Lord. He is the Lord. But when he came, though he is infinitely above you, he made himself beneath you, taking on the form of a servant, becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross, taking the lowest possible estate. Though he was one in being with the Father, he submitted himself to the Father's authority in order to be a servant to you when you were his enemy. And now because he has done that, because he labored among you and did the labor that you couldn't do, living the perfect life you should have lived, dying the death that you deserved, you can now be brought in. And instead of an enemy of God, become a brother to Jesus Christ, a sister to him, a child of your heavenly Father. So you, of course, you need someone to be over you. Because left to ourselves, we've screwed it up. And left to ourselves, we'll continue to screw it up because not everything we want is actually good. And so Jesus comes, and before he is risen above us, he makes himself lower than us and dies in your place so that when he is exalted to the highest place, you could know him as your brother and friend and not as your enemy. So that in submitting to him, you could realize that not everything you want is good. And having an authority over you is actually for your good because Jesus is an authority over you who reigns in order to give you life and not to take life, who gives you abundant life rather than killing you, even when you deserved it. Now, if you know him like that, you can honor those leaders that he places over you. Apart from him, you're always going to be resisting. You're always going to have to fight every authority to protect yourself and guard your own selfish desires, frankly. But if you know his authority as a loving and kind and gracious and serving leadership, you can look at the leaders that he places over you, the imperfect, flawed, broken leaders he places over you, and say, "You are over me in the Lord." Look, you have great pastors here at City Light Maniac. I know each of them personally. You just don't get it, right? But you're really blessed, okay, with great pastors. They're not perfect. They're going to fail you. He never fails you. There is one over them who is over you who will never fail you, who will never fail to use his authority to love you and do good to you. And you know it because he did not spare his own life but gave it up for you. Esteem your leaders in love because of their work. You know what the work of your leaders here is to do? It's to preach Christ. It's to point you to him. It's to lead you towards him. It's to correct you even when you stray from him. But don't you want that? Like if you know Jesus like that, you don't want to leave your walk with him in your own hands. Come on, like I would mess that up in a day. I need people who love me enough to give me Jesus and to call me back when I wander from him, and you do too. So esteem your leaders in love because of their work. Don't fight against this God who died for you. He didn't fight for himself. He fought for peace with you when you were fighting against him so you could go from being his enemy to being his family. Are you a part of his family today? Or are you still fighting against him? If you've not yet trusted Christ and experience that peace with God, the first way you can respond to this message today is to believe this good news of what Christ has done for you. To in your heart entrust yourself to him and say, "Yes, Jesus, you are over me because you came beneath me first." If that happens for you today for the first time, there's a model prayer on your Connect card there that would give you words to say to trust Jesus for the first time. And if that happens, please let us know. If that's already happened in your life, we want to invite you, after I pray, we're going to sing to the Lord. We invite you to join us in that. And at any time during those three songs, to also take communion. There's stations on my right and my left and in the back of the room, the four corners of the room. It includes gluten-free options. What you do is you tear off a piece of the bread, a sign of Jesus' body that was broken for you. You dip it in the juice of the wine, a sign of his blood that was shed for you. And as you do that, you're getting to taste what the one who is ultimately over you gave up, that he was torn apart, that he shed his blood so that you could go from being his enemy to being his family. So if you believe that today, we invite you to come forward and take. If you don't yet believe that, we don't want you to feel like you have to pretend you do by coming forward and taking. We'd ask that you not receive communion today, but we're glad that you're with us. You're welcome to sing, to watch what's happening. There's also going to be people in the back of the room that would love to pray with any of you who are here today. Anything that's burdening you today, go to the back and get prayed for during these next three songs. I'll also be up front. If there's anything you sense that God wants to say to the church through you, a word or a scripture that God brings to mind, and you're a member of our church, come to the front and let me know, and we'll prayerfully consider whether that's a word of prophecy that you have us share. So let's take a moment to pray together, and then we'll stand and sing to our King.